Welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution on PodClips. This podcast is designed to offer valuable perspectives and insights to individuals engaged in the mediation process. Listeners will benefit from the experience of the profession's most accomplished mediators who share compelling stories of conflict and the lessons they have learned from handling challenging and intriguing disputes. Throughout the episodes, you will hear firsthand accounts of how conflict has impacted the lives of those involved and discover how mediation enables individuals to move forward free from the burden of ongoing disputes. The discussions on this podcast provide practical guidance on addressing and overcoming difficult issues, helping listeners achieve more satisfying outcome in mediation. Whether you're a mediator, an attorney, or someone who has participated or is considering participating in mediation, you'll find actionable advice and encouragement. Your host, Len Levy, is a mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services, Inc., a leading provider of alternative dispute resolution. Len brings extensive experience, having litigated complex cases for over 30 years before transitioning to mediation in 1998, and has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. Len Levy's expertise and dedication set the stage for insightful conversations and meaningful learning for all listeners. And now, your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Season 6 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast designed to add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. In each episode, you hear a story about a conflict, the impact it had on the lives of those involved, how resolution was achieved, and the lessons learned from both the conflict and its resolution. Many of the details that are going to be expressed in telling this story may be altered. And that's basically to maintain the essential confidentiality of mediation while still capturing the core essence of the conflict and its resolution. Now, today, we are going to be discussing a legal malpractice case and what attorneys did or didn't do impacted the lives of their clients. And it's in the context of a divorce. Joining me today is, and we're very, very fortunate to have David Rosen, who is a retired LA Superior Court judge. And David is also, he's a very highly respected mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services. And he brings more than four decades of litigation, judicial, and neutral experience to his work involving complex civil disputes and other matters in a variety of areas. Judge Rosen's background is really varied, and it involves personal injury, toxic torts, employment, professional liability, and commercial disputes. He is particularly adept at emotionally charged or legally complex cases, where the stakes are high and the personalities are strong. And we see those from time to time, don't we? And in those cases, expectations can be very deeply rooted. And Judge Rosen is just the man to find out, basically through his calm authority, his careful listening, and his ability to distill complexity without losing sight of the human dimensions of the dispute, which is essentially going to be coming into play in the story that he's telling. By the way, before transitioning to full-time neutral work, Judge Rosen served 8 years on the Los Angeles Superior Court, and nearly half of that tenure was spent in family law, an assignment that he values for its human depth and daily impact. And from 2021 to 2023, he presided over a civil independent calendar, handling a broad spectrum of tort, contract, and employment disputes, and even served in a criminal assignment earlier in his judicial career, and basically has a very broad-based judicial experience, and prior to that, a broad-based litigation experience. And thank you for joining us today. David Rosen, you're going to be up and telling us this story about this family that, I guess it's still a family, but they're having some problems post-dissolution.
Well, Len, thank you for that very kind introduction. I did catch how you almost aged me even more than I'm already aged, so I appreciate your quickly correcting that. It's been a great experience for me to do mediations and arbitrations through ADR services. This particular case that we're going to discuss today was unusual in several ways, not the least of which was that it's a malpractice case, as you said, a legal malpractice case arising out of a family law case, a dissolution of marriage, or commonly known as a divorce.
Let me ask you specifically, the parties came to you how?
The plaintiff in the case we're discussing, so it's clear, was the wife in the dissolution case, the underlying case. And she was suing the lawyers who had represented her during the first several years of that case. Like many dissolution cases involving significant assets and children, the dissolution case went on for quite a while. People who don't do family law may not realize that the five-year statute, which kind of puts a limit on how long a civil case can go, does not apply in family law. So they can go on forever, and there are reasons that this one did too. In any event, the lawyer representing the plaintiff in the malpractice case was someone that I knew from my practice years. I think I should point out that he doesn't typically litigate. He's a lawyer who he's a well-respected lawyer, but he's a lawyer who does other kinds of things in the context of practicing law. And he certainly doesn't typically do dissolution cases or anything to do with family law. But for reasons that were not completely shared with me, he'd been retained by the wife in the dissolution case to sue her lawyers. I should also mention that I knew independently and through different reasons the lawyers who were being sued, or at least some of the lawyers in the firm who were being sued. And as you know, Len, with a mediation like this, the lawyers and the parties have to agree on who the neutral is going to be. So I assume that because they both knew me and figured it might work out to have me as the neutral, they agreed.
Right.
The
and
law
speaks
firm
speaks volumes, by the way, when you have that kind of situation where both sides know who you and you know them. It speaks to the level of trust that they have in your ability and your integrity.
I have to humbly agree with you. I would also say, though, that there are many times in my mediation practice where I don't know either of any of the parties or the lawyers, but I've been recommended by someone else, some mutual contact. There also have been a lot of cases where I know the lawyers on one side, but not the other. And there's a little trust there. The main thing for me as a neutral, though, is that for mediation, almost always, both parties have agreed to be there. They've agreed to go to mediation to try to resolve the case. Occasionally, they're compelled to be there, but not usually, and not in the case we're discussing today, as distinguished from arbitrations, where quite often one party absolutely positively does not want to be there, but they have to be. And that's, as you can imagine, sets up a very, very different dynamic. Right. But in this case, both parties and the lawyers agreed to try and hash out a settlement of the malpractice case. The law firm that was being sued, that is the family law firm, which is a well-known or was a well-known law firm in the family law community. I should mention a pretty small and tight community because there aren't that many firms that specialize in family law. They had two different law firms representing them at the mediation. So in the defense room, there were lawyers from the firm being sued, the defendants, And then they had lawyers defending them. It turned out that they had a lot of their own money at risk in this malpractice case because of what's called a self-insured retention or a coverage or lack of coverage up to a certain amount of money. It was never shared with me what the limits were of their self-insured retention, but they were significant. And then there were lawyers representing the malpractice insurance policy for the lawyers being sued. So three different groups of lawyers, all conceivably on the same side, but as we'll see, not exactly on the same side.
A few conflicting interests going on there.
Yes, and a lot of money at stake, and so those conflicting interests reared their ugly head.
Okay, so what was the claim of malpractice? What was the basis of that?
So it was a long-term marriage. The husband, who was not part of the malpractice case, not a party, of course, in the malpractice case, the husband was himself a well-known lawyer, and he and the wife had been married for, God, more than 20 years. So clearly, a long-term marriage, colloquially and under the law. They had a couple of children, both of whom were getting close to being adults, but not quite. And one of the children arguably had some disabilities, which would arguably affect their ability to get a job and support themselves. That's an important issue in the family law case because even though that child of the marriage was going to be an adult soon, there was a strong belief and a strong reason to believe that child support would have to be paid relating to that child for a lot longer than him turning the age of 18 because of his limitations and disabilities. What was the malpractice? Well, the parties had been married for a long time. They finally separated about 10 years before this mediation. They had separated, and the dissolution case started soon thereafter, about 9 years before the mediation. And then, as so often happens, the parties who were not bitterly divorcing reached an agreement pretty quickly after the dissolution case was filed. And they put it in writing in a deal memorandum. That agreement became very important because, as I'd mentioned, the husband was a pretty well-known and extremely successful lawyer, or at least that was his reputation. And the wife obviously wanted to be treated fairly, both with respect to the spousal support that she'd be owed, colloquially the alimony, the child support that she would be owed for the reasons that I've already mentioned, and then also the division of the marital property, a very big deal in a case where there's a lot of marital property, a lot of community property. And the parties early on, again, about 9 years before the mediation, reached an agreement which they memorialized in a MOU, a memorandum of understanding, which had bullet points indicating how much the child support was going to be, that is, how much the husband was going to pay, how much the husband was going to pay to the wife in spousal support, what the community property was, and how the community property would be divided. At that point, the parties didn't really go further than their memorandum of understanding. For several years, they were pretty much getting along, though obviously separated. They were not technically divorced. The marriage still existed. The MOU was out there. The husband was complying with the parts of the MOU that were in effect at the time, namely the support of the kids and of the wife. There wasn't really a problem. After the parties had been separated for about 4 years, the husband found new love and wanted to get married, but that meant he had to get divorced.
Funny
And
how that
that's,
works.
yeah, funny how that works. And of course, though this wasn't really discussed in the mediation, as is most typically the case, once that happens, no matter how well the ex husband and wife had been getting along, suddenly there's at least a chill in the air, if not a freeze. And the wife and her lawyers realize that they need to get this marital settlement agreement in the form of an agreement that the parties are going to sign. It takes a while to get that done, but they do it. There's a marital settlement agreement. And then, after a couple more years go by with the dissolution having been granted, but the divorce still pending because some of the issues were not fully fleshed out, the financial issues, the husband decides that he's not going to comply with the marital settlement agreement. He says at that time that he can't afford what he initially agreed to in terms of the support amounts for children and the wife, and even in terms of some of the property division. But then the claimed malpractice rears its ugly head. Family law is a highly technical practice. It's, as many lawyers and judges will tell you, it's often not conceptually difficult, but there are a series of traps and trap doors in the family code that apply very specifically and very strictly to cases. And if they're not complied with, woe to the lawyer that has that problem. One very specific requirement is that the parties exchange and file with the court a document called a PDD, Preliminary Declaration of Disclosure. And this is a sworn document, just the way it sounds, filed by each side, exchanged with each other, where they state under oath what their income and assets are. You can imagine how critically important that information is, but the specific requirement that this information be exchanged under oath with each other using a judicial counsel form called the PDD is inviolate. And a marital settlement agreement that is entered into when the parties have not exchanged the PDD is unenforceable.
Wow.
No matter what, it's kind of like a statute of limitations. As I used to tell my clients, no matter how strong your case is, no matter how good your evidence is, if you blow that time to file the lawsuit, your case is over. Similarly, here, despite all the facts I've given you and more that the parties had agreed, they had the MOU, they reduced it to writing, it was signed. They did all of that without having exchanged the preliminary declarations of disclosure, and therefore that marital settlement agreement was unenforceable.
Wow. We are going to take a break now, and we're going to get into on the other side of the break how that failure to file the PDD affected the lives of the parties. And I'm Len Levy, and we're talking with David Rosen, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution. We'll be right back.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Lynn Levy. I'm chatting with David Rosen, who has now set the scene for this dissolution that was seemingly settled, and all of a sudden it turns out maybe not so much. So what was the practical effect of the failure to file the preliminary disclosure declaration?
The PDD.
Got
First,
it.
I have to tell you that when the law applied to this case, that is when the parties signed a marital settlement agreement without having exchanged the PDD, that's where the law kicks in. Neither party and neither side were aware that they had failed to do the PDDs. Strangely, we're talking about lawyers on both sides in the divorce case that were experts. And it came out really during the mediation in sort of a cautionary tale that everybody thought they'd done it because they always do, which, as you know, is not quite good enough. Initially, when the husband in the divorce case is going to renege or not comply with the marital settlement agreement, again, he doesn't realize that he's got an airtight basis for backing out of it. So he argues that, and puts on evidence that he can't afford to pay what he's agreed to pay, including even some of the property division. The wife at that time, not realizing that she is in deep quicksand because of that failure to file the PDD, presents conflicting evidence that he can indeed comply with the marital settlement agreement, that his financial circumstances, the husband's, are really no different than they were when the MSA was first entered into, or when it was first a memorandum of understanding. And some further litigation goes on in the dissolution, including a motion filed by the wife's lawyers, now the defendants in the malpractice case, but a motion filed by the wife's lawyers in the dissolution case to enforce the marital settlement agreement under Code of Civil Procedure section 664.6. It's commonly used in all sorts of civil cases, but it applies, with the right evidence, in a family law case. It comes out in the mediation that during the time the wife's lawyers are preparing that motion and preparing to litigate it, they first realized to their horror that while they drafted the PDD, they never actually filed and exchanged it.
Wow.
Nor, by the way, did the husband, but that's kind of beside the point. That's where the second alleged malpractice occurs. They initially don't tell their client, that is the wife, now the plaintiff, of their failure to do this. At first, it seems, and this is a conclusion that I drew without stating it during the mediation because it would have been incendiary. At first, it seems that these expert family lawyers, upon realizing that they didn't actually exchange the PDD, didn't realize that that made the MSA, the marital settlement agreement, unenforceable. There's a statutory law that says you must do the PDDs, but there's case law that says if you don't, any MSA that you've entered into before those PDDs are exchanged is unenforceable. Initially, the wife's lawyers were apparently unaware of that case law. The wife, of course, is not a lawyer, doesn't know anything about what I'm telling you. And they sort of get ready to argue this motion to enforce. The bills to the wife have been pretty high, and now they're sky high because the wife's lawyers, again, the defendants now being sued, are famous for being really good lawyers, but they're also famous for being really expensive.
So let me just interject something here. This is affecting the wife. Obviously, she's making a motion. How is this affecting her on a personal level in terms of the things that she can't do because of the unenforceability?
On a day-to-day basis, it comes out in the mediation that there was nothing that she couldn't do. The husband had started to pay, I think, half of the agreed to spousal support on a monthly basis, and a similar reduction in the child support. But to be blatantly honest, the amounts that were originally agreed to were so high that regardless of whether the husband could afford it or not, it was not going to affect the day-to-day life of the wife nor the children.
Right.
Nobody lost a house. Nobody got evicted. No property that was now in dispute was somehow sold or taken away. It was all about, this is what you agreed to pay. Why aren't you paying it? Meanwhile, the husband, in preparing to oppose the motion to enforce, he and his lawyers at first don't realize the PDDs have not been exchanged. Then, maybe when they realize that fact, they don't realize the implication of it, which obviously makes it a slam dunk winner for him. No MSA, not enforceable.
Right.
And they're preparing, and they actually file an opposition talking about changed circumstances, changed financial circumstances, which are, of course, relevant in family law for sure. When it comes close to the time for the hearing of the motion to enforce the clearly unenforceable marital settlement agreement, the wife's lawyers, again, the ones being sued in my mediation, finally tell her, gee, we've got a problem here. We didn't exchange these preliminary declarations of disclosure. And we think, I don't think they actually told her at that time that the marital settlement agreement was unenforceable. What they told her was it made their motion to enforce it a loser. So we should withdraw the motion. They tell her this in kind of a sideways manner, not in writing at first and not directly. It's sort of an afterthought in a meeting they're having to strategize. At least this is what the wife claims. So they take that motion to enforce off calendar. At that point, because the wife is so upset about where the legal bills are from her lawyers, even though ultimately the husband might have to pay for them, she's still got to deal with them at first. And because she now knows that they made at least that mistake of not exchanging the PDDs, the wife fires those lawyers. That is, the wife fires the lawyer she later sues as part of my mediation. She hires new lawyers. The new lawyers come in, review the file, obviously, and make it very clear to the wife, okay, here's what happened. Your lawyers did not file and serve or file and exchange the PDDs. They did not tell you until they ultimately had to. And your lawyers never had the marital settlement agreement reduced to a judgment. The only way the MSA is totally enforceable, even assuming the PDDs have been exchanged, is if that MSA is incorporated into a judgment, typically as an exhibit of the paper, well, not paper anymore, but paper judgment, the actual judgment in the dissolution file. The wife's lawyers had never done that. What was the effect on all this in the malpractice case? It really went to causation, and let me explain why. In any malpractice case, professional negligence case, the plaintiff has to prove, first of all, that the professional, here her family lawyers, acted below the standard of care. Pretty clearly, their failure to exchange and file the PDDs and their failure to reduce the MSA to a judgment, and oh, by the way, their failure to tell her as soon as they knew what they failed to do, those are all below the standard of care. The lawyers who were being sued had an expert who they said in their mediation brief was going to testify that they had not acted below the standard of care. But it became clear during the mediation that that expert was basing his conclusion that the lawyers had not been below the standard of care on law that had to do with a different technical family law document. The final declaration of disclosure, that can be waived. That's not mandatory like the preliminary declaration of disclosure. There's not a lot of case law on failure to exchange the PDD. Why? Because it hardly ever happens. Everybody knows you got to do the PDD and exchange it. So
It's such a blatant failure that no one has ever bothered to deal with
Well, I wouldn't say no one has ever, but
it.
certainly there's not a lot of case law on it. And similarly, because it's such a blatant failure, it's such an obvious thing that a family law lawyer knows you have to do, that the lawyers on both sides in the dissolution case thought it had been done, even though it hadn't. So I started to talk about the elements of the malpractice case. The first is plaintiffs got to prove the lawyers were below the standard of care. It became quickly pretty clear in the mediation that the woman's divorce lawyers had acted below the standard of care for the reasons I mentioned. What's the next element of the malpractice case? Well, did that failure to act or perform to the standard of care cause any damage to the client here, the wife? If so, how much damage? So causation became really the key defense of the lawyers in the malpractice mediation. In their brief, they talked all about how they didn't do anything wrong and there were no damages. They talked a little bit about causation, but at the mediation, once it became clear that they had messed up, causation became the critical argument. In what way? Well, the wife's ex-lawyers, the defendants in the mediation, showed that the husband wanted out of the MSA and didn't even know that it was unenforceable. The husband wanted out of the MSA because he couldn't afford to pay all of the things it required. And the wife was arguing about whether he could pay them or not and willing to give up some of those things, it turned out, at the time of the family law matter. Turned out in the mediation that she knew that his circumstances were not exactly the same. So the defendants, that is the lawyers being sued in the mediation, argued, well, even if we did screw up, it didn't actually cause the plaintiff any damages. Of course, the plaintiff was able to counter that. She would have gotten the benefit of the original MSA, or at least she would have gotten it if they'd filed and exchanged the PDDs, and if they'd reduced the lawyers had reduced the marital settlement agreement to a judgment in a timely fashion, because then the husband's burden to get out of the terms of the MSA, to modify the judgment, would have been much, much higher. So she might have ended up in the same place. And then the damages were disputed. The millions of dollars the wife was claiming as damage for the malpractice were hotly disputed.
Once you get to that point and you have at least a recognition that there's exposure because of the failure to file the PDD, the effect of that was not something their expert had really fully appreciated. It basically undermine their expert opinion? Was that the key here?
I think to a degree, the expert for the defendant lawyers seemed to think that the case law on failure to file the final declaration of disclosure was applicable to cases involving a failure to exchange the preliminary declaration of disclosure. And the truth is, they're two different things. Even though the pieces of paper are almost the same, the family code statutes applying to them apply differently. And the failure to file the PDD creates many more consequences than does the failure to file the final declaration of disclosure.
So, had you, as part of your mediation preparation, I know it's your habit to speak with the attorneys in advance. Did you actually do any research into the background of this, or what did you do as a mediator with a very substantial background in dealing with these cases? What did you do to prepare for that mediation?
So, as you started to mention, Len, I do in all my mediations, a preliminary call. The good part about that is it acquaints me, and it's a phone call, by the way, not even a video conference. I do one with each side or one with each party, or more accurately, their lawyers. It acquaints me with those lawyers who I've never met before. As to those lawyers who I've known in a different context, either as a colleague or as a judge, it acquaints me and them with my mediation customs and habits and practices. And for that reason, first of all, that pre-call is long before I know any of the facts of the case. So in this situation, all I knew was that this was a legal malpractice case. I might have even known, well, I knew that it was a legal malpractice case arising out of a divorce case, but I only knew that because the defendants being sued in the malpractice case only do divorce law. So, they didn't have to tell me that. To the good, at the time of the pre-call, I don't know any of the stuff I've been talking to you about for the last several moments. All I know is what I just said. It's a malpractice case arising out of a divorce. I say that's to the good because it allows me to talk to the lawyers for each side without getting into arguments, without getting into saber rattling, and without getting into who's right and who's wrong. It's more just about how are we going to do the mediation? How's it going to be conducted? I find out for sure who's going to be present, who, if anybody, is going to be over Zoom. In this case, it was a live mediation in the sense that all the lawyers were present with me in ADR's Century City offices, but and the lawyers being sued were there, were physically present. But the plaintiff, the wife who was suing for malpractice, was by Zoom. And it was good to know that beforehand. I also got to know a little bit about the bare bones of each side's claim, but this is long before that I saw their briefs. And then I explained to them things like I typically don't do a joint session unless both sides want to do it. I find out about where the, in this case, the malpractice case is in the courts. Is there a trial date? Who's the trial judge? That's helpful at mediation if it's a trial judge that I know, because I can open both sides' minds about things that might happen, given that's the trial judge, things of that nature. And again, I just get to know both sides and they get to know me a little bit more. These are 20 to 25 minute calls that I do before the mediation. Second part of your question, what did I do to prepare? Well, once I got the briefs, weeks later, but still a week before the mediation or so, I knew about the PDD because I'd been a family law judge. And I have to admit that when I saw in the plaintiff's brief that it hadn't been exchanged, I thought, well, that's unusual. And then when I saw in the defense brief, basically implications that they didn't realize they hadn't exchanged it until literally months and really years later, I started to form in my head where this thing was going. Also, the defendant's emphasis on, that is the lawyers being sued, emphasis on that they didn't do anything wrong, but even if they did, it really didn't cause any damage. And oh, by the way, the damage the plaintiff's claiming is wildly inflated. Then I went back and looked at the basis for the plaintiff's claim of damages, which had a lot of substance to it. So going into the mediation, I knew we were going to be talking about all three elements. Was there negligence or malpractice? Did it cause any damage? And how much damage, if any, did it cause?
So, what the impression I'm getting is that someone in, and this is true in certain types of mediations, having knowledge of the substantive area in many mediations is really irrelevant. It's more understand process and understand what's driving the parties and all of that. But in this particular case, having knowledge of the substantive area allowed you to recognize where the problem really was. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in fact, during the mediation, one of the lawyers who was being sued, not the lawyers representing them, but one of the lawyers who was being sued, finally gave up the ghost on the negligence because they could see, though I was being gentle and a little circumspect about it, they knew I'd been a family law judge, But more important, they could see that I remembered what the law was, and that, gee, really, you can't get out of not having exchanged that PDD. That's really a problem. And it would be a problem in front of anybody. I do want to disagree with you just a little bit. Your general comment about most mediations not requiring the neutral to know too much of the technical details or the technical law underlying the claims. I think it's a little bit like the teacher who stays at least one chapter ahead of the class in the textbook. I think you do have to know enough to be dangerous, as they say. You have to know enough to call people out in a gentle, often humorous way, as a practical matter, what's really important and what isn't. And also, to the extent that the parties and their lawyers want me during a mediation to offer some forecast as to how things in their case might play in front of this judge or that jury, something which I do with hesitation and with great disclaimer. It helps if I know a little bit more than not much at all about how these kinds of cases usually go. I always emphasize that, as the stockbrokers say, prior performance is no guarantee of future returns, but it still helps in mediation to get people to focus on things, weaknesses or strengths of their case that maybe they hadn't thought about, and as to the other sides as well.
Well, we're going to take a break and digest some very substantial insights. We're going to get into more insights after the break. This is Len Levy. We're on Masters of Dispute Resolution and chatting with retired Judge David Rosen.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and our guest is David Rosen, who is a retired judge and full-time mediator who handles mediations in a way that, I don't know, there are some judges that will do this the way Judge Rosen is doing it. There are some judges who are not quite as effective. And I think part of the reason is that the way Judge Rosen approaches conversations when the problem is a legal matter, and you don't have authority that you used to have when you were on the bench, has a different flavor than what you're used to when you're a sitting judge in a settlement conference context. Can you comment on that?
I've been retired from the bench now for a little over 2 years, and I still find myself forgetting momentarily that I no longer have the black robe or the authority with which it carries, but I'll make a joke of that. I'll catch myself and I will say something like, look, you have to do it this way. And then I will say, well, of course you don't have to do it that way. I'm forgetting back to the time when I was on the bench. And that will usually get a laugh from the lawyer who I'm talking to and even their client. On the other hand, I do think that with some cases, especially where the client on one side or the other or both are less sophisticated about the law and less sophisticated maybe about business or, as in this case, family law principles, that part of the reason I got selected to be the mediator, to be the neutral, was because I used to be a judge. And the lawyers can say, Judge Rosen says this and Judge Rosen says that, even though I don't say it that way. In this case, as I said, I think that the lawyers who were being sued, as well as the lawyers defending them, were using the mediation, at least initially, as sort of a trial run to see whether they could persuasively argue, persuasively to a judge, persuasively to a jury, that they had not acted below the standard of care. I felt, as I've indicated already, that it was clear that they had made some mistakes, and they were pretty black and white mistakes. And I tried to make that clear by repeating it in a non-confrontational, non-order fashion, until finally, maybe 3 or 4 hours into what ended up being a 9-hour session, the defense kind of gave up the ghost. They didn't come out and say, yes, you know, they didn't fall on their swords, as it were, but they changed their tone to arguing more about causation and damages, which I'll come back to. The plaintiff's lawyer, the lawyer representing the wife in the malpractice case, had really been incredulous that the lawyers being sued would argue that they hadn't committed malpractice. It was so clear to him that they had. And though I never said to him, okay, they've admitted they've committed malpractice or anything of that sort, it became clear to the plaintiff's lawyer when the tone shifted from liability to causation arguments that the defense had finally accepted in their own minds that they were, that they had committed some malpractice here. The causation argument again revolved around some emails and some court documents, most of which were authored by the husband in the underlying case, in which he was giving all the reasons that he couldn't comply with the agreement he'd entered into before he realized that the agreement was legally unenforceable. Damages-wise, in this case, and this is really what was driving it, the plaintiff's lawyer, that is the lawyer representing the wife in the malpractice case, was able to itemize and give some substantiation for about 10 different items of damage that would result to the wife if the MSA, or since the MSA, was not going to be enforced. The total dollar amount of those damages was about $8 million. And without getting into the real narrow specifics, the $8 million was made up by such things as the far less, though still substantial, monthly spousal support that let me back up and say, by the time we're in the malpractice case, the dissolution case has concluded. The parties are divorced. They reached a different settlement and it's been reduced to a judgment. So we are comparing the terms of that in the malpractice case, the terms of that judgment, the actual judgment, to the terms of the judgment that would have been entered had the wife's lawyers done all the things they were supposed to do. So the child support would have been maybe not doubled, but at least a third more every month. And given the numbers we're talking about, generally speaking, that third's a lot of money, especially over a period of years. Indeterminate, maybe forever, with respect to the parties, or the parties' one child who was going to have to be supported into adulthood and conceivably always. The spousal support was about half monthly. Again, a big number over the wife's life expectancy. The other issues of damage. The husband in the original MSA that was unenforceable was going to pay for all of the wife's legal expenses in the dissolution. In the judgment that was ultimately entered after all of this was hashed out in the dissolution case, the husband did not have to pay for everything. He had to pay for a lot, but not for everything. And then there were some elements related to how the husband and wife's property was characterized. Some of the things that the husband had agreed were community property in the unenforceable marital settlement agreement were now claimed and agreed to be separate property. So the wife wasn't going to get her share of it. And some of the valuation of the property, which was community property, was reduced significantly in the judgment that ultimately was entered. So it's also interesting to note on the causation angle that there were emails introduced in the malpractice case from the time that the parties were still litigating their dissolution case, where the husband is essentially now the parties realize that the wife's lawyers had messed up. The wife knows it, the husband knows it, their lawyers know it. So while the wife and the husband are arguing about what the actual judgment in the dissolution case is going to be, there are a couple of emails where the husband says, and I'm paraphrasing but nearly quoting, "You'll be able to make up the difference from all the money you get in the malpractice case against your lawyers." That was in the mediation briefs. The defense tried to use it to argue that this whole malpractice case was a sham and a setup. Well, again, it's hard to argue that when there was in fact malpractice. The wife's lawyer in the malpractice case was not at all embarrassed by the husband's emails, because he was essentially saying, well, you know, he has a point. And then the one other twist that I wanted to mention, I think I told you at the beginning of this session that I knew the husband, who was himself a lawyer. I knew the husband from practicing law for all those years before I was a judge. He obviously knew that I was the neutral in the mediation of his wife's malpractice case against her lawyers. And at one point during the mediation, I'm sitting in a physical breakout room with the wife's lawyers. The wife's on Zoom, both video and audio, in that room, so we can all see each other and talk to each other. And the wife says that she's going to take a call from her ex-husband, because he has some opinions about arguments that should be made in this mediation and in the malpractice case and how much he should accept.
Well, there's an unusual dynamic.
Yes, and I said at that point, well, wait a second. As you know, I know your ex-husband. We're not close friends, but we're more than acquaintances. Mm-hmm. And so I'll step out of the room while you're talking to him. From your home on Zoom, you're speaking on your phone, but I can see and hear what you're saying. And the wife says, no, that's okay. You can stick around to hear what he says. I know that you know each other. And I then turn to the wife's lawyers, with whom I'm sitting in person at ADR Services. And they both kind of shrug their shoulders like, well, okay, you can stick around. So heard from him. And ultimately, as often happens in mediations, once it became clear that there was liability on the part of the family law lawyers, once it became clear that their causation defense, while not absolute, did have some legs, especially as to some elements of the damages claimed, and once a couple of things about the damages became clear, things started moving faster towards resolution. What became clearer about the damages? Well, I pointed out to the wife and her malpractice lawyer that a jury was going to hear this malpractice case, and they had to consider the effect on a jury of 12 tried and true citizens in the community of somebody coming in and saying, in essence, and I'm making these numbers up now, these are not the numbers, I'm upset because of what happened, because I was going to get $200,000 a month, and now I'm only getting $150,000 a month. Might be a fact economically, and that is indeed a $50,000 difference, but how does that really play to a jury? That was something that maybe they hadn't considered. On the other hand, when I talked to the lawyers for the family lawyers, that is the defense lawyers for the defendant lawyers, I pointed out that they weren't going to look so great to that jury either before you even get to the merits, because the jury was going to hear how much they were charging per hour, how many hours they were billing during and after their clear, excuse my French, screw up. And so they had some flank to guard as well. And then, as I mentioned, the lawyers were self-insured for a significant amount of money. I asked, but was never allowed to hear, how much coverage they had and when the coverage started. The lawyer for the coverage, the lawyer for the insurance company, got very upset with me when I had the temerity to even ask the question. But in any event, I stepped out of the room at one point late in the day, 8.5 hours in, and it apparently had become clear to the defendants, to the lawyers being sued, what the price of poker was going to be, how much they were going to have to pay to get out of Dodge and get out of this case. And that was honed down. It became clear what the plaintiff would accept, and the defendants decided to pay it. Now, whether that was all out of the lawyer's pocket or mostly out of the lawyer's pocket and some from the insurance, which is what I think happened but don't know, I'll never know. But the case did resolve, and the money was paid.
And what do you think was the, if there was one thing that put this over the edge, what was there, a realization, an epiphany, something that happened that the attorneys finally realized the jig is up, so to speak?
I think there were two. I know you're asking for only one, but there were two, and at two different points in time. The first was when it finally became clear, and I don't know exactly what made it clear, but it finally became clear to the defendant lawyers, the lawyers who were being sued, that their argument that they hadn't been negligent or they hadn't committed malpractice was just not going to fly. That was an epiphany for them. Then later, there was an epiphany. I guess I'm going to go for three. There was an epiphany by the plaintiff and the plaintiff's lawyer, the wife and her malpractice lawyer, that while they had a darn strong malpractice case, they had weaknesses on some of the causation and weaknesses on the dollar damages they were claiming. Not weaknesses that would get it anywhere near zero, but weaknesses that would prevent it from getting to $8 million. And then the third epiphany was when the plaintiffs finally made it clear, we will not go below this number to settle this case. We will try this case. And the plaintiff's lawyer, though not a family lawyer and not usually a trial lawyer, was clearly ready and able to try the case. And at the same time, once the defendants understood, as I said before, this is actually what it's going to cost to get out of Dodge, they made a decision, which took them a while with me out of the room, to come to, that they would pay the number.
You know, what one thing strikes me as somewhat ironic, the husband's attorney also committed malpractice.
That is correct. And that was not discussed during the mediation, because the party who was aggrieved by the failure to file the PDDs was the wife.
Right. I just look at it somewhat ironic in that essentially taking advantage of your own attorney screw up really benefited the husband.
And that's right. And what helped him in that regard, what helped him appear innocent, if you will, was there was a lot of documentation in court papers from the family law filing and in emails between all the different parties, which showed that the husband, when he was trying to get out of the original MSA, had no idea that it was unenforceable. And his lawyers had no idea that it was unenforceable, nor did the wife, and nor did at first the wife's lawyers. By the way, one other little fact, which I think was poignant. One of the lawyers present, one of the defendant lawyers present at the mediation, was the associate who had personally, arguably failed to file the PDD, and finally realized late in the game, oh my God, here's the draft, but we never exchanged it. And then there's emails from that associate to her superiors, the more well-known family lawyers, in which she's saying, oh my God, I'm so sorry this happened. Then her superiors don't really realize the implications of the failure at first until the associate who made the mistake explains to them, no, no, you don't understand. This makes the MSA unenforceable. Well, she was brought along to the mediation and she was mortified, clearly. I don't think there were ever any consequences. She kept her job and that sort of thing. But the dynamic between the associate and her superiors, even at the mediation, was, as I said, poignant.
You know, I'm trying to think of whether there occurs to me anything that the attorneys could have done prior to this mediation to have changed the dynamic. And I'm kind of at a loss for that.
I've thought about that. I thought about it then. I've thought about it for this podcast. And this is speculative, of course, on my part. But I've been speculating so much, why not continue to do so?
I appreciate that.
I think, had the defendant lawyers said to the plaintiff lawyer before the mediation, you know what, it's a liability case. Because that happens a lot at mediations. And all we're talking about is causation and damages. Had they said, you know, it's a liability case, we think you got some problems on causation and your numbers are wild high, it certainly would have changed the attitude and the psyche of the plaintiff and his client, the wife. They came into the mediation justifiably angry that the defendants weren't admitting that they screwed up, because they did. Had they been able to come in and say, all right, this is a liability case, and you know, they say we got some flank to guard on our causation and our numbers are too high, let's talk some more. Would it have reduced ultimately the number that they would have accepted? I don't know that. But it certainly would have changed the tone and therefore maybe the number. Maybe they would have gotten to their number faster. I don't know.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for a really in-depth discussion of a seemingly simple but very complex family law malpractice matter. And before we wrap up here, David, how would people best reach you if they'd like to either discuss some aspect of a mediation or hire you for a mediation for them?
Or an arbitration. I'm going to give you two ways. One is to contact directly my case manager, who, as you know, Lynn, the case manager is the one, like the court clerk, who actually makes all these wheels turn on time and in a even way. My case manager is Ella Fishman. You can be reached at Ella Team, that's all one word, Ella Team at adrservices.com. Or you can email me directly. It doesn't have the word retired in it, even though technically it should. My email is judgerosen@adrservices.com.
Well, thank you. And really, thank you very much for agreeing to appear and appearing on this. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you did. And I'm sure our audience will. And I hope to have you back on some other matter in the future. This was a very enjoyable discussion. I also want to thank Daryl Wayne, our engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infigen Labs, Inc. I hope you continue to enjoy the episodes and the stories that we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.